you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Trigger warning. The following episode contains descriptions of graphic violence and adult language. Viewer discretion is advised.
I'm Danielle.
I'm Max.
And each Wednesday, we crack open a bottle of wine and dive in to some thrills, chills, and spills. This is Innocent Till Tipsy. First off, we have a Patreon.
Yay! So
if you are not on there, make sure that you join us because we're going to be doing stuff for spooky season. We hope we're fingers crossing on that one.
Of course.
Got some ideas. It is the time of year. And then we have live Q&As on there for after our episodes. We also have polls. We have all sorts of things, additional content on there as well. And we want to build a community. We want to see you on there. So if you haven't joined us, please make sure you do.
And our live Q&As are so fun. I love hearing from everyone. And we, of course, start with the episode, sometimes digress into all things spooky. But it's super fun to talk together super and with fun. Our patrons. I love it.
Super fun. So if you haven't already done so, join us there. Also, make sure you're liking, rating, subscribing, doing all the things so you don't miss an episode depending on where you hear us or watch us from, because we are on YouTube as well. I've noticed a few people don't know that. So make sure you're following us so you don't miss an episode. And it also really helps us out if you rate and subscribe as well. But yeah, we have a new episode. And this is our anniversary episode and we are merged out as well.
Yes.
I don't know if anyone can see me.
Oh, no, I'm hiding behind my hair. I love this. I actually love this hoodie.
The half hoodie?
This is the crappie. Yep.
It's actually the most comfortable. So I never thought I'd be confident enough to wear a crop top hoodie. And I actually love this one. I have worn it so much with my mom jeans.
I feel it hits perfect. Because
it does.
Bulky and
And
I like comfy, it. I wear it with leggings all the time.
Yeah. And it's light enough too where I'm not in Florida. Anyways,
not sweating.
Yes. There's a lot of self-promotion for 5 minutes. If you're still with us, hi, welcome. It's nearly our 1 year anniversary.
Here's the 1 year. Oh my gosh, let me pour myself a glass.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. I'm ahead of the time here. We filmed.
I was going to say, in honor of our 1 year, I know I've done this bottle before, but it's one of my favorite $20, $25 bottles of decoy. I feel like it's usually $20. Yeah, so I'm bringing this back.
Cheers.
Cheers.
I'm still drinking the bottle from our last episode. That we filmed today. So if I'm a little loopy, this is why.
We start early, 10 a.m.
Oh. It's fine.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Pretty good.
I have to show you. Speaking of, what did you call her? Patrice.
Patrice.
I don't know if you can see this. Let me see.
Oh, I love it. Mm-hmm. You need to get that made of little.
Little. He's so small.
Somebody make a graphic for you. Oh, I love
little.
Little with the moth. So cute.
So silly. Me and my crazy cat lady stuff. I have another one here. Embarrassing. Anyways. 1 year anniversary. Exciting. Our first episode was based on the wrongful conviction of Ryan Ferguson and Charles, or Chuck Erickson as he's known. And there's been some major updates to this case. I don't know if you're aware of it.
I don't know if I'm aware of it. I can't wait to dive in.
So we're going to dive in. I won't give you the updates yet because just in case you didn't watch that episode, I don't want you to feel like you have to go back. So let me just recap it because we're going to be talking about something completely different this episode. So don't feel like you have to go back and watch that episode.
Stay with us here. Yep.
Stay with us. Okay. So here we go. These two men would spend almost a decade in Charles is still there. So but Ryan would stay in prison for almost a decade for the brutal murder of a beloved sports journalist, editor, 48-year-old Kent Heitholt on Halloween night in Columbia, Missouri. This was a brutal and fast, looked like personal murder. Kent's body was found by his car. He'd been struck 11 times with a blunt object. They believe it was a tire iron, but that object obviously was never found. And then he was strangled with his belt, and only the belt buckle was ever found. So belt is gone, and it was broken off, and it was a leather belt. So just imagine.
That's so brutal. Yeah.
The brutality. So brutal. And they believe this was committed anywhere between 6 to 8 minutes. So it was a quick. The only thing stolen would be Kent's watch and his keys, which also doesn't make sense with the narrative of what they convicted Ryan and Chuck on, that they were trying to steal alcohol money on Halloween night. There's no money stolen. Kent would leave behind a wife named Deborah and their two children, his daughter Callie and his son Vincent. It wouldn't be until over 2 years later, like 2.5 years, when the two culprits would be arrested for his murder, which was 17-year-old Ryan Ferguson and Chuck Erickson.
It's because they didn't have like any real leads at that point, right?
They had to go cold. Well, and it's interesting because we are going to get into it. Shouldn't have gone cold.
Right.
It shouldn't have gone cold. And we'll touch on why it shouldn't have, because there were common sense things the police should have done that they just didn't do. So this conviction happened after Charles read an article, okay, about Kent's unsolved murder from where Kent used to work, the Columbia Daily Tribune. He reads this article. Right. And this just haunts him, right? And he soon begins to worry about how he might have committed the murder on Halloween night because he was blackout drunk, right? And they were doing drugs too, I'm pretty sure, like cocaine. And this leads him to obsess. He is having dreams about the case. And then he looks at the sketch. And I wanted to send you the sketch because it does kind of look like him. And that sketch leads him to think, I know. Did you see the sketch last time?
Let me send it to you. No, I don't remember. It's been so long. Yeah.
So I found out a lot more with this case this time. Mind you, that was our first episode. We had audio issues. We had all sorts of things going on with it.
We had to start somewhere.
You know? Well, we had to start somewhere. And that's why I don't want you guys going back to it, because there is literally no need to suffer through that episode.
oh, okay. I can see why this looks like him. Mm-hmm. In the eyes, the eye shape.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean,
I can see why he obsessed a little bit about it. Yeah. And especially I actually looked up his mental health issues in this, and there's a lot, unfortunately, going on with Chuck. So it makes sense that he like
projected it.
He overanalyzed. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So because of this worry, he contacts the police. And he tells them that they were partying on Halloween night. The police obviously bring him in, bring Ryan in. The police are telling Ryan, like, hey, your friend's selling you out. And I mean, he was like, I think we might have done this. Meanwhile, he knows nothing about the crime, right? He knows nothing about the murder. He knows nothing about
actual details.
No details. And if you watch his interview with police, they are handing him details, which they should not have been doing either. They're trying to solve this case, though. You can understand like both sides of it a little bit, but it's rough, ethically rough. And then there would be also no physical evidence tying either the two to the crime, even though that crime scene was littered with physical evidence. We've got tons of fingerprints, I think over 17. We've got DNA evidence out the wazoo, hair, blood, all sorts of transferable evidence that just didn't link either of them to it. So
wow,
it's wild. So this leads to a conviction. Ryan would be sentenced to 40 years and Charles to 25. We'll talk about the witnesses.
Did he plead? Or he went to trial? Chuck.
Chuck took a deal and talked about
his is way lighter.
Ryan.
Yeah.
His is way lighter. And he also said that Ryan had been the one to carry out the strangling, all of that, right? Because from the, it's rough.
That's
it's
awful.
Rough. It is awful. And there would be witnesses, which we are going to touch on later, that also one pointed the finger literally at Ryan in court, said he saw him, and that was the nail to the jury.
Right.
For Ryan. Yes. Now, what if we told you there is reasonable evidence that somebody else committed this crime? There was someone that saw Kent, the last person that night of the murder, that should have been questioned and was not.
I don't think I know this part.
Yes, you do. We did it. I was like a sudden, like it was one of my last parts of the episode. And I'm like, it should have been first. And this is what we should have focused on. Now that I'm looking back at like what we should have done. So somebody, he was the last person to see Kent alive. The last person to talk to Kent on this earth. Yes, you know
I thought
this.
You meant somebody saw him do it. Okay.
No. Gotcha. No.
Yeah. Absolutely, he should have been questioned.
Ah! So not only that, he's pictured at the crime scene hours later. He says he went home at 2:20 that morning, yet at 4:15, 4:30, he's peering around a door.
So nuts. He's like in the crime scene photos.
He's in the crime scene looking at where Kent's body was found hours.
He came back to the crime scene.
He came back to the scene of the crime. And yet nothing of his has ever been searched. He has never even been a suspicious person in this case, let alone an actual suspect, not even a person of interest, nothing. And nothing was searched of his, not his clothes that he washed that night after, before he went to bed. He washed and then he comes those back. Clothes.
Yeah, he just washes those clothes.
And then he comes back in different clothes. He, like, none of his car was in search. Nothing was searched. His articles, because he worked with Kent, were found around Kent's car. Everything points to this person logically, legally. Nothing points to him. We are not lawyers. However, everything points to this one person, but nothing has been done. Now, we are going to go through this. We are going to look at the murder of Kent Heitholt, who this last person was, and why police didn't question him, and who his friends were in higher places as to why police did not question him. But before we touch on that, real quick, lots of Ryan supporters do not believe that Chuck Erickson deserves a crack at freedom because of the choices that he made going in, turning in Ryan, the pain he inflicted on Ryan's family. Ryan also now kind of has a fan base in and of himself. He's been on the MTV show. What was he on recently? It was a race show. What is that show? The Amazing Race. Wasn't he on that?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. But anyways, also not to mention, he put the Heitholts, that entire family, through the ringer with his false claims, elongating this. But here is the huge problem with this.
Yep.
Charles Erickson is up for parole this January, January 9th, 2023. He could get his freedom. And while I think he deserves his freedom, if he gets this freedom and he is allowed out and then parole goes on and then he is cleared, well, not cleared, but, you know, he served his 25 years, all of that, this will never be investigated.
Because obviously it's a closed case since he's been convicted. And so their crack at, like, actually pursuing another person would be like exonerating him and then reopening the case. Yeah. So he can't.
Yep. Ken Heitholt's murderer has gotten away with murder if this is how this is going to proceed. Ryan Ferguson's father is still on the warpath with this. He has a change.org petition that we will link below talking about trying to get him clemency, something to get him out of jail in a different way so that they can then have that case tried, you know, like actually look through, because the amount of negligence, obvious negligence, things that were done completely wrong, like you always hear, the husband did it, you know, the last person that you talk to that murders you
is the suspect number one.
You start there. You don't start with two 17-year-old boys that were blackout drunk on Halloween
that maybe had a dream. It's been weighing on them. Yeah.
So we are going to dive into all of this and more, this time strictly looking at the murder of Kent, and then that who should have been suspect number one. But before we dive into that, let's talk about Kent Heitholt.
Yeah.
So I found new information about Kent this time. Last time I had to like scrounge. I couldn't find much, which is always disappointing to me when you can't find
much
on the victim.
Right.
But this time I was able to find a lot of his co-writers, people, co-workers that worked with him, and they're all writers. So they put their memories into words. And so I wanted to share a little bit of that. So
cool.
Ken Heitholt was called Heidi by his friends and family. And he was known as a very kind, jovial, easygoing man. He was described as a 6'3", 300-pound man that was a teddy bear. So he's huge.
I've seen pictures of him and he's like, other dwarfs, other people.
Yeah. He looks like he was just like such a nice guy. And then but that's the thing too. He's so big. Why would two random strangers try to take this huge man on in the middle of a parking lot?
Yeah.
Seems strange, but he's a gentle giant. He was a prankster and he had a standard greeting of, "Hey now."
Cool.
He was known for always carrying extra food in his car for the local stray cats. God, we love a cat,
Gotta
daddy.
Love the cats. Yep.
Love it. This is something that Michael Boyd, who we're going to talk about extensively, would actually mention in one of his statements concerning the night that Kent was murdered. This is him taking care of the stray cats. So this was one memory that I found that was from Louise Pierce Dorch. And they had written it out. It says, "One of my favorite stories about Kent came from a sports writer. He and Kent were covering something and Kent ended up spending the night at the guy's house. The only bed was in the guy's small child's room. He got up early because he thought Kent might scare the child when it woke. He eased open the door to find Kent sitting on the floor playing a video game with the kid. The child looked up and said, "I like your big friend, Daddy."
I like your big friend. That's so cute. What a cute memory.
Isn't that cute? Kent wasn't much of an athlete throughout high school, but his future did lie in sports journalism. He graduated from the University of Missouri School of Journalism in 1975. It's located in Columbia, Missouri, which is where he would later be found murdered. But Kent would move for work. He then married Deborah in Spring Hill, Tennessee in 1981, who he had those two children with. And then later the couple would decide to move their family back to Columbia, thinking it would be a better place for them to raise their children together.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
Kent took his final job at the Columbia Daily Tribune. He was just there at the Tribune for a few years, like 96 to 2001. And I do always like to mention with this case, this happened very shortly after the 9/11 attacks. So the media really railroaded it. It was totally railroaded. And then I feel like this case was railroaded again because of Ryan's dad. And I'm not saying that in a negative way, but Ryan's dad really became super dad in this whole case, and he took on his son. But we've totally lost Kent in this whole story, what happened to Kent that night. So I just always kind of like to mention that before we get into what happened the night of the murder. So right. It's the early morning hours of 2:26 a.m. to be exact, on November 1st, 2001, when Shauna Orndt calls 911. So she and her three coworkers from CNS Cleaning Services had arrived at the Tribune that evening for work. So they don't even work for the Tribune. They're just there.
They're the cleaning service. Yeah.
One of which is Jerry Trump, who we're going to talk about too, because
Jerry.
Mm-hmm. So she stepped outside at 2:22 a.m. Remember, time is of the essence of this case.
The timeline gets muddy.
So she steps outside for her break 2:22 a.m. and she's witnessing the shadowy figure by Kent's car. So she's like, that's weird. It's Halloween night. People are up to no good. So she runs back in. She gets her coworker, Jerry Trump. She's like, please come out, like, be with me.
Yeah.
You know, for this. When they both arrive outside, they do see two figures stand up behind Kent's car. Okay. And because they entered the light, one of which really entered the light, she would be able to create that sketch. She's the one that was able to give the description to create that sketch. But she would also later tell prosecutor Kevin Crane that those two people who walked toward her were not Ryan or Chuck. She knows for a fact. Yeah, not those men. We still don't know who those other two men were, but it was not. But we know from the last episode, because of this, prosecutor Kevin Crane made sure to ask around this to Shauna so that she didn't say anything about it in front of a jury.
So she never gets to say to the jury, it's not Ryan
or Charles. Mm-hmm. Yes. So he did make sure, though, to ask her coworker, Jerry Trump. And we'll talk about why he did that a little bit later. But what you need to know right now is prosecutor Kevin Crane was probably, at that point in time, he was, and he probably still is, very good close friends with Michael Boyd. Kent's coworker. So Michael Boyd.
Strange that they're friends.
Very strange. Very strange. So Michael Boyd was the last person to see Kent Heitholt alive. That night, he and a few other coworkers had been working late at the Tribune in order to catch up on work for the upcoming basketball season. That's what they were there for. He worked directly under Kent, and he had had several arguments with Kent over his work. Don't know what that all entails, but they were not getting along. The night of the murder, Mike reported into work at about 9 p.m. after taking his kids trick-or-treating. So he's there late as well.
Yeah.
As I said, time's so important in this case. So at 2:08 a.m., Kent has switched off his computer. It's shut down. He would still need that time to get out to the parking lot. And investigators say that this murder happened within 6 to 8 minutes. So keep that in mind for all of this. Then 911 was called at 2:26. So we got 2:08 to 2:26.
So she couldn't have been on her break very long.
She could not have been out on her break very long.
This would happen. Yeah.
Yeah. So here's where things get interesting. So first story by Michael Boyd of what happened that evening. Now, this was conducted by Detective John Short of the Columbia Police. This detective would later be found to have been friends with Michael Boyd, but he changes his race to white. That's his description.
Right. It's not a mistake, right, that he's identified as someone that's white and then he's actually not.
Yeah, because Michael Boyd was an African-American man, or it still is, excuse me. But it's interesting that his friend would change his race. Yes. So he actually calls him at 3:30 a.m. on November 1st. Michael Boyd? Michael Boyd. So they call Michael Boyd Steven. That night shortly after the murder is committed. 3:30, he's called to give a statement. Okay. Mike says he left promptly at 2 a.m. Okay. Walks out the back door of the Tribune. He talked with Michael Henry, one of the other janitors in the area, for about 5 to 10 minutes outside the Tribune. So that's taken him to 2:05, 2:10, right? As they're talking, he says that Kent comes out the door and walks past them towards his vehicle. Okay. Because there's like this little alcove area in the door. So that's where Mike still says he is. He's right by the door. So Kent walks out towards his vehicle. Mike says that he then went over and talked to Kent about a cat, a stray cat that had been clawing Michael's tires. I have owned cats for my entire life and I've never known them to claw tires.
Or why at 2 a.m. you'd be like, this is worth discussing. Let's just go home from work. Yeah.
This is it. So after that conversation had ended, Michael then says he went to his car at about 2:20 a.m. This would have been when the murder's happening.
Yeah, right. He'd been right there.
Yes. So he
in the crime scene pic. The parking lot's not huge. It's not like he was like far away or would have been far away from Kent or Kent.
No, and he gave locations to the officers. Like, I'm not going through. I've condensed this. We're going to link a YouTube video in the bottom because he will not only change his story five times. He changes his story 5 times, but he also changes the car that he was in. One of those cars has still to this day never been found to search.
Oh, it's blue or it was red blue or something, car. Right?
Yes, yeah. Blue or it was red. We don't know.
Forgot.
Yes. And he changes everything about his story. Like it is drastically different as time goes on.
He was listening to the radio or to a cassette in his car. He's just sitting there. Mm-hmm. And then, there's just too many changes.
There's too many. So to quickly go through it, he says that the conversation ended, first story. He goes to his car about 2:20. Mind you, Kent's already being attacked at this point. He noted that as he was leaving, Kent was entering his vehicle and he saw no one else in the parking lot. Michael Boyd saw no one else in the parking lot. Yet at 2:26 a.m., 911's alerted to Kent's lifeless body because he was gone at that point in time. Mm-hmm. Second interview. It's conducted by the police office in person this time, November 1st. So the very next day, that same year, at 11:45 p.m. So late interview, next day, right? So after working with Heitholt that entire night, Michael still stays the same with saying that he left at 2 a.m. That's consistent. He says that he talks to Mike Henry, for several minutes. Then he says at 2:10 a.m., he gets into his car and adjusts his radio, playing about 3 songs. He then says he sees Kent leaving. So he pulls up to Kent as he's exiting the lot and holds a 3 to 5 minute conversation with Kent. Again, this is vastly different from what he had said. He was outside his car. He had never entered his car. The first story, he just went over to talk to him. Yep. I would say I would say the first story is probably the most accurate, and that's when Kent was attacked for legal reasons. Who knows who did it? But
the first story being the most accurate,
I would say Kent. I would say Mike went over, started talking to Kent.
Oh, about cats. Something, yeah,
gotcha. Cats, but or something set him off about work, because remember, sure, Michael Boyd's articles of high school sports, which was, yep, his demographic for the paper, those were all found in evidence by Kent's car after he, why would Kent have
like under articles? Kent's, weren't they like kind under, of like under Kent's car?
Under it's not Kent's
like he
car.
Just dropped a paper. He like his whole portfolio of like work, like a folder, is like kind of like under Kent's
under
car.
Kent's car. So why like would that all be theme there? Yeah, it doesn't. I think that's probably the closest statement to the truth, is that he approached Kent, something was said, and Kent was attacked by who knows who, but and I would say that
air quotes for listeners. Yeah.
Yes. So he holds a 3 to 5 minute conversation with Kent, vastly different from his first statement where he said he talked to Kent about the cat clawing his tires before. He doesn't even like say anything about that. Then he states that he left the parking lot between 2:15 and 2:20 a.m., which is also different than his first statement. He's moved up that timeline, and he says that there was nothing suspicious in the area. Interview three is conducted several years later on, yeah, Valentine's Day 2005 by a private investigator who we assume was hired by the Ryan Ferguson family. About 2 a.m., Michael Boyd is heading to his car. He's now changed not only his, or he's now changed where his car was parked. Excuse me. His car is parked in a completely different spot in the lot. He said he sat listening now to a cassette tape instead of the radio.
Oh, right. Yeah.
When he sees Kent leave. So he drives up to talk to Kent for about 1 to 2 minutes. Says he exited a completely different way than he said he'd ever exited before, and he would never go back to saying that he exited this way again. Says that he saw Kent's car lights go on, and Kent drove off while he was driving off. So get this. The investigator then notes, we made this discovery last night. The investigator then notes that Michael Boyd becomes overtly emotionally. They have to stop and, whoa, he has to gain composure before continuing on. This reminded me of that Amber Heard thing. You remember they ask her about TMZ and she says something about she knew TMZ was leaking the tape or like whatever else. And then she grabs her face and she has an emotional response to what she's just, mm-hmm, said, that she was caught. We noticed this was what happened last night when we were like looking through stuff was, he gets this emotional response.
He's like, and oh, they have to pause. Yeah.
They have to pause while he gains composure. Then they restart the interview and Michael Boyd restates that he pulled out of the parking lot and assumed Kent was behind him. So he's changed the story because Kent's car never moved. Kent, yeah, never started his car that night. Kent was dead.
Yeah.
I think the door so was
he's
open.
Like, oh shoot, I just made up that I saw Kent drive away. Like, which couldn't have happened. Yeah.
He was caught. That's what I think. He was like, oh my God, can I take a break? Right.
Yep.
So the investigator then asked if he knew he was the last person and why he hadn't been questioned. Why had his house been searched for things? Had his car been searched for things? Had he been tested for things? And Boyd said, like, no, why would they do all those things? And the private investigator said, well, actually that's protocol. If you're the last person to see someone alive.
Yeah.
Usually this is what investigators do. And then Boyd says that he didn't know why they wouldn't, but he knew Detective Short, was friends with Detective Short that night.
Oh, yeah.
And he also, this was said almost, I feel like, in a threatening way, the way it came off. But he said he also knew Kevin Crane, prosecutor Kevin Crane, who would be the prosecutor on the case for Ryan Ferguson. He knew prosecutor Kevin Crane very well, and that he had contacted prosecutor Kevin Crane before his interview to quote unquote make sure it was all right.
Oh, for him to do the interview. Right.
For him to do the interview.
Yep.
So like after he gets flustered, he doesn't know what he's talking about for a second. He's now like gone to this like defensive. It's like,
by the way,
mode.
I know the investigator and the prosecutor.
And the prosecutor so. On this case. On
That's
this
why
case.
I didn't get investigated. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Kevin Crane's still a judge, by the way. Wild for all his Brady, mm-hmm, violations and everything else. Next interview was on July 24, 2005, conducted by lead investigator of the police force. This time he added that new car, totally different car. I believe it went from a blue car, 1991 Cutlass Sierra. Now it's a 1992 red Plymouth. that he's talking about.
Yeah.
And he's sure. Every time he is absolutely sure, no, this is the car I was driving. No, this is the car I'm driving. I'm 100% sure. So this time he affirms the first two statements. I don't know how he affirms them both, but he says he did say them. That was it, even though they changed. But this time he also says that as he's exiting the building, he sees two college-aged males near the dumpsters. So he's now added in Ryan and Chuck, right?
Because they had already been arrested. Yeah, they were. Oh, he knew about them. Yep, they've been in the media.
Yeah. And he couldn't identify either of them, but he didn't think that they looked suspicious. And then the last interview where he's changed the story again for the final time was conducted by another private eye, most likely hired by the Ferguson family, on June 5th, 2006, in person. Now, he says he didn't leave the Tribune this time until 2:10 a.m.
Yeah. He just gets – he's just lost his way on these stories. Like, they don't even make sense to the physical as evidence.
No. Then listened to about 3 to 4 songs on the radio, he says.
So plus 10 minutes. I mean,
And then he sees Kent leave. He says he go, and then he changes his car, whatever is, you know, now he's in the 1992 red Plymouth. And now he says that he sees Kent leave the Tribune at 2:20. So they didn't leave like together until this is it.
Oh, what's her face is on break at 2:22. Like that would not add up.
Yeah. So he sees him leave the Tribune at 2:20. He then pulls up to his car, has a 4 to 5 minute conversation. This puts him well past the time that Shauna has already called 911.
Yeah.
Kent's dead already. He's not having any conversations. Like, it doesn't make any sense. He then mentions that as he's leaving, those two college-age kids, again, that he can't identify, he says he almost hits them and he's scared that they're going to take down his license plate. So this has changed drastically, and that's why he didn't list it before, because he was scared that he'd get in trouble for almost hitting them.
That's why he didn't tell police about these two college kids. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So I didn't mention.
Also, what's up with the blue car? Didn't he like sell it? And that's why they never, I mean, one, they never properly investigated him, but also like that car is gone. So he changes from a blue car to a red car, but it doesn't matter because it's not like they're going to go swab that blue car.
Yeah. So here's his story. He says that he traded his blue car to Enterprise Rental. As of 2010, after he'd given this story, it was still listed. The title was still to Michael Boyd. And there's no record of this from Enterprise Rental Car that he traded any car to them.
No.
So where the hell is the car?
Burned.
And
in
why? Well, this is it. Like, why?
In a lake.
Why is it Ryan Ferguson's father finding out all this information through private investigators and not the police? Like, this is what doesn't make any sense when he's the last person to see.
Because it's case closed, because Ryan's in jail and Chuck's in jail.
Exactly. It's so beyond bonkers. So despite all of this evidence, these contradictions, all of this, Michael Boyd has never been considered a suspect or a person of interest in this case. No investigation into him has ever been conducted. No search of his car, no search of his house, his fingerprints, his DNA has never been tested against any of the evidence concerning the murder of Kent Heitholt. And none of these statements explain why he was photographed between 4:15 to 4:30 a.m. at the Tribune after he had said he was already in bed. He'd washed his clothes. He went to bed.
Yeah, except for he's in a crime scene photo peeking at the crime scene.
So, So this is an excerpt. We read it in the first episode, but I wanted to reread it again just to kind of get it through. This was from Ryan's civil suit concerning when Michael Boyd was questioned and like why he had returned to the crime scene. So it says, and of course, we now have Kathleen Zellner on our team, so we are doing great. Like, yes.
All the details come
out. All the details. Yeah. Yes. So Boyd has admitted that when he arrived home after the murder, he immediately washed his clothes and put on a long sleeve sweatshirt. Boyd has stated that he arrived back at the Tribune at approximately 4:15 or 4:30. When he arrived, he saw Heitholt's body face down. This is impossible, as Heitholt's body was turned face up when he was discovered by other Tribune employees at approximately 2:25 a.m. The only other individual that knew Heitholt's body was originally positioned is the killer. So he was face. He knew. He knew what the killer would have seen.
Did he say that show that he was face down or face up? Or
Yeah.
I was going to say, I knew there was something that was like, yeah, that's valid. He was face down, but the killer would have known. Yep.
Yeah. Voight has also stated that he saw paramedics and a lot of emergency lights at the scene when he arrived. However, the paramedics had left the scene long before 4:15 a.m. In fact, defendant Nichols was called to the scene at 2:30 and the paramedics were already gone by the time he arrived.
Yeah. It doesn't add up. It doesn't make just so far after the fact that it was poorly investigated to begin with. There's so much evidence here too, like physical evidence.
There's so much that could be tested, but just hasn't.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be like, I'm so scared for January to come because it's just not going to be tested because why waste taxpayers additional dollars? We already got our guy, so what's the point? And it's like, this is everything. And the fact that I personally feel it's a cover-up, because you're friends with Detective Short, you're friends with Prosecutor Kevin Crane, it's all very easy. Like, you can understand why these grown-ass adults went so hard on 17-year-old men. Like, this was so convenient for Chuck.
They were really easy. Yeah,
really easy
to like pin this on.
Yes. So the night of the murder, Jerry Trump, police originally said, and you can hear it in the 911 call, they said Jerry Trump has no useful information. I mean, he wasn't the one to originally see the two of them there. He wasn't the one to give the police sketch. He doesn't really know what those guys looked like. And who knows who those guys are? It's Halloween night. Like, everyone's all over the place. But
they think it could have been if there was somebody else, like bystanders that like happened to see something and maybe got scared or like... Yeah,
that's it.
Someone crossing the parking lot. Like,
I think
a lot of other plausible reasons.
So he suddenly, though, Jerry Trump has enough to testify as a witness. Like, you remember, he got on that stand. He pointed out Ryan in the courtroom. And that was the nail in Ryan's coffin. Come to find out, Prosecutor Kevin Crane had a meeting with him concerning his statement. Jerry Trump was a sex offender with 2 years probation being held over his head when they had this meeting. And Kevin Crane said to him, "We're pretty sure we have the guys who killed Mr. Heitholt, but we need you to identify him."
Yeah.
There's a lot, like, it's wild. So then Jerry goes into, and he wasn't even supposed to be a witness either. That was the crazy thing. Originally, Crane just said, "You have to confirm, like, these are the guys," kind of thing. You won't even be called into court as a witness, but he was.
Didn't his wife like send him a newspaper clipping? Yeah. He had like never even seen them before until he saw them in the paper.
And then
later on testifies or something. He's like, "Yeah, I'd never seen them before.
Yeah.
And I saw them in a paper clipping that my wife sent me while I was in jail." So,
yeah, he said his original story, I believe, was he opened it up and he was like, "Oh, those are the guys that killed Mr. Heitholt." But that wasn't really the story at all. And he would later recant. He would recant that entire testimony and apologize to Ryan. He said, "If there's anything I could do, it would be apologize to you for like robbing you of nearly a decade of your life." And mind you, Charles is still being robbed of his life. So,
I think Ryan spoke publicly or something on like he forgives him. He understands that it was like the pressure or something. He's like been very forgiving in this situation to both Chuck and to that witness.
Yeah. Yeah. But Crane did knowingly withhold evidence from the court, which is known as a Brady violation. I don't know why he hasn't had any retributions on this, because it wasn't just this he withheld information on, but Shauna Orndt's testimony. She had told him, I know that this is not Ryan or Chuck. And yet that was never entered into court, that she knew that it wasn't those men.
Not disclosed to Ryan's defense?
No. It was just Dan. Yeah.
The defense would have asked her on cross.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. On cross, 100%. 100%. And now Kevin Crane is a judge, even with all these violations. But I don't know if they ever, like, I know when Kathleen got her hands on the case, she was just like, "We're getting Ryan out of jail." And that was her main focus, her main point. But it is disturbing to me that someone that's so corrupt, I believe, as Kevin Crane is like in higher power, you know? Yeah.
Scary.
Very scary. So due to his guilty plea, Charles Erickson has had a much harder time proving his innocence in this case. And he wasn't lucky enough, I feel like, to have a father. Like, I mean, mind you, I don't know his parents and what they've done, but like the fact, like, I was watching
Ryan's dad drove around with a car of Ryan's face and has a Netflix documentary like made about
and yes. Ryan's dad, like what the video we linked, I mean, it is of all of his statements, and you can find all of Michael Boyd's statements online. I read through them all for this, but there's a video linked to that literally demonstrates, and it's from freeryanferguson.com. It is made by Ryan Ferguson's father. He has actors, everything. He's trying to get his son. He's like, my son is not spending 40 years of his life in jail. No. So like, it's
he's like out there giving moonlit tours of the like the crime scene. I mean, he's committed to getting Ryan out.
Prosecutor Kevin Crane spoke at a university and he flew a banner over the university, free Ryan Ferguson. Like he was not playing. He was like, no, I'm getting my son out. But not everybody has those kinds of that access to that kind of help. So and like Kathleen, like Kathleen said, she's like, once you're in jail, once you've been prosecuted for something, it is so hard to get you out of jail. Absolutely. So, wild. So like Ryan's attorney, Charles's attorney has been petitioning the court for appeals. He filed a petition in June of 2020. It was denied. They then went to the Missouri Supreme Court of Appeals, which was also denied in August of the same year. But he pled guilty. I think this is where we're like getting that. So there's a couple options from here. He can either get clemency from Governor Mike Parson, or new evidence has to be introduced that was not found originally in the onset because the police were either buddy buddies or they just didn't care in the case. So this is why we're sharing this story again. If you know anything, there is a way to contact the police in this case, try to get some information out to them, but also please sign Ryan Ferguson's dad's the change.org petition to get Charles out of prison. This is the end. We are at the end. This is being released in October. It is January. He's going to get out of prison. And
wow.
Like it's not going to Kent Heitholtz real under the killer. Bridge.
No justice for Kent.
That's it. I'd also encourage you, if you are even the least bit interested in this case, if you live in Missouri, if you know anything concerning this, head over to freecharleserickson.com. Have a look at the court documents that are provided. There are court documents there. There's crime scene photos. There's all sorts of things that you can kind of look through yourself. I feel like this is a case where you feel like you're screaming into the void and still nothing's been done. It's wild to me that Ryan has been freed. Charles is still in prison. Nothing has been done to investigate. Even the people that are higher up in this case that have been looking at this case that have obviously just at a glance of it, just totally screwed this case over. Like,
yeah. And again, that's why Kent gets lost in his own case, because there's been so many other side story issues instead of justice for Kent, like solving it actually.
Yes. And so I wanted to say, I think we need to thank the unsung heroes of this case, which were the reporters and the editors of the Columbia Daily Tribune. They are doing an amazing job of upholding Kent's legacy, upholding his memory, but they also are doing investigative journalism constantly on this case. And their perseverance to this case has been unparalleled, except for, I would say, Ryan's dad. But yeah, we're at the end of the line with this case. So we're at our 1 year anniversary. This was the case we started with. There's been some updates. He could be released, which is great, but we want him released for the right reasons. We want him exonerated from this entire nightmare. Literally a nightmare.
Yeah.
So wanted to share the story again. This isn't obviously the full of it. There's a Netflix doc, Dream Killer. Is it Dream Killer? Yeah. I think. Yeah. That was done by Ryan's dad. But yeah, these are the updates that we have at this case, and
it's crazy.
It's done. It's crazy.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, it's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy done securely online, and you will be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours.
And what I love about BetterHelp is that you can log into your account at any time and send a message to your therapist. And they respond with timely and thoughtful responses. And you can schedule your weekly video or phone sessions so you don't have to sit at an actual therapist's office. You can do therapy wherever.
I love it because they have such a broad range of things that they can talk about and are experts in. So if you feel like something's overwhelming you, like I know right now with me, content seems to be overwhelming me. Forever, I'm always distracted by the office or
scrolling on TikTok for forever and not really paying attention to what's going on within me. So I feel like that's been super helpful.
Yeah. And if it's not your match, they'll match you with someone else. So I know I had to try with one therapist and then I switched to another therapist that was a better fit for me.
It's also way more affordable than offline therapy, and financial aid is available for those who may need it.
Join the over 2 million people who have taken charge of their mental health by visiting betterhelp.com/ITT. That's betterhelp.com/ITT.
And BetterHelp has a special offer for ITT listeners. You'll get 10% off your first month if you go to betterhelp.com/ITT. Again, that's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/ITT. But we will be talking more about this on our Patreon this week. So make sure that you are joining us there, joining our community. We do have additional content there and we will be talking about it all there. But just wanted to do a quick run through because this is kind of what we started on. And we at Innocent Tipsy, we do really love a good wrongful narrative. The Johnny Depp, Amanda Knox. What else have we touched on that was like a wrongful narrative? I know there's so many.
And Starve Rock.
Yep. Yes, the Star of Rock murders. So we've touched on a lot. So
lots of wrongful convictions.
Lots of wrongful convictions. So just a quick refresh, but also more information on what's going on, what did happen, and where we are now.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Crazy, crazy.
Crazy.
All right. Well, what a ride. What a great year. And then for the next year. So cheers.
Cheers. Till next time.
Huda Media Production.